Thank you. I feel like I'm very privileged to be able to speak to talk about this. This came out of my dissertation at the receiving end, a phenomenological study of Great Lakes region African women as recipient of refugee services in the United States. Once again, my name is Hadija Nyansekuye. I am a visiting assistant professor at Metropolitan State College of Denver, where I teach for the Department of African and African American Studies. I'm also from Rwanda, some small country in Central Eastern Africa. So if my accent is too thick for you, feel free to stop me midway. Before I go further, I don't have anything to disclose as there is no conflict of interest or anything. Like the previous presenters that I applaud very much, I feel like my own presentation kind of brings in another piece of the puzzle around refugees and immigrants in general. My first interest in this topic was not really, when I get to reflect about it, it wasn't an interest that was there. It was kind of gradual. Growing up in Africa in the 70s and the 80s, this is post-independence Africa, where we actually start seeing Balkanization and movement of people moving from countries to countries. And I remember in the 70s when I would see people one of the newspaper that was very prevalent at the time, Jeune Afrique. That was the only one magazine that was known through the whole of Africa that told us about the rest of the world, and the rest of the world would know about us. And I keep seeing these skeletal people going, streaming into Uganda, into Kenya, into Tanzania, and they were all coming from the Horn of Africa. And of course, as a child, I didn't know what to make of it. That wasn't my problem, and I wasn't thinking about it. And I remember coming to this country in 1984. I think I was 3 months pregnant with my third child, and a friend of mine, I was in Arizona, at the University of Arizona, and a friend of mine steered me to go watch a presentation on refugees. I was sitting there kind of really not knowing what I'm doing. That wasn't my issue. I wasn't interested. It wasn't something I could relate to. But then, having lived in Rwanda, I don't know how many of you know about Rwanda and most likely have heard about the Rwandan genocide. Come 1990, the war was upon us. And all of a sudden, I remember I was teaching in a secondary school, and then I woke up one morning and I thought, my God, if this war goes on, that means I may have to leave my country. I may have to go live in a foreign country. I already have 3 children. I was pregnant with a 4th. It was very scary. But at that point still, I wasn't really aware of what refugee life, refugee movement, refugee system entails. When it came 1994, the genocide was upon us. And this time, I don't know if you know much about Rwanda, but I'm one of those who were married to someone who was not from my ethnic group. He came from the group that was being targeted, and so had to leave, thankfully, had to leave early. But then by July of 1994, all of us, the rest of the country, also had to leave the country. For the first time, I found myself outside of my own country. And I felt, I remember feeling and looking across the border to the Congo where I was, to the Eastern Congo, and thinking about, oh my God, I can't go 5 miles from where I am. I'm not allowed to go home. And I remember feeling like, my God, I am nothing. I am nobody. I don't even have the right to go to my house. And so that feeling stayed with me when I actually get to migrate, to immigrate to this country. I came as a student, lucky me. I was going to the University of Denver, and so I was going to study social work. I had just realized that not only did I lose my home, but also my means of survival. You know, I have been teaching for 19 years, and all of a sudden, the languages I spoke, because I used to teach modern languages, I spoke French, I spoke Kinyarwanda, I spoke Swahili. None of those were going to be useful in this country. What was I going to be? And so I went into social work, because I just needed something else. I needed to find something else to do, and I needed to find especially another profession that I can use wherever I would go, because at that point I realized home is really very relative. And so when I went into social work, you know how we do, I mean, I don't know how many social workers are here, but when I went into social work, so I had to do an internship. I went to do my first internship at the Gathering Place, which was a homeless shelter for women and children. Not only my speaking English, despite my education, I came with that thick accent, as they call it. And I remember picking up the phone and people would say, can I get someone who speaks English? And so that's kind of gives you a sense of, should I even bother answer the phone? But anyway, fast forward, the following year, I did my internship at this time at the Rocky Mountain Survivor Center, which was more of an agency that worked with legal issues and mental health issues for asylum seekers. So I thought I found my niche. Well, guess what? It's true that I was working with a population that was most likely like me, but the model that was being used was a Western American model. You know, it's they needed if the client has to come up at a certain time, they had to speak clearly and they had to express what their needs were. If you don't, then the assumption is you don't have any needs. So I found myself torn between advocating for the client into saying, oh, wait a second, I don't think that's what's going on, and into being the social worker what I was and providing the services without having to put myself on either side of the services. And then I noticed something else, is that every time there would be like an evaluation of the services, they would always ask a client how they feel, he or she feels about the service they received. And then I noticed that there was what they wanted to tell their service providers, and then there were other things that they were telling me. And I thought that this is an interesting dynamic. So fast forward, when I decided to do my research for my dissertation, I thought I wanted really to give a chance to the recipient of the services to actually say what it meant for them to be recipient of services. So that's how I ended up with the receiving end. And so I used phenomenology, and I thought that was very fitting because phenomenology allowed me, this is about the theoretical background, theoretical framework, but I'll come back to that after I explain about the phenomenology, because it helped me, it allowed me to give a chance to the participant to actually describe their meaning of a lived experience. And as you know, in research, of course, it was not only a research method, I also had to come up with a theoretical framework. What was interesting about me was I found myself being both the researcher, but at the same time kind of have some kind of a relationship with the clientele and the participant I was talking about. And so it was kind of a challenge. Was I talking about my own experience, or was I talking about their experiences? And so when I found the social constructivism, I thought that was a theoretical framework that helped me to bridge that gap without me feeling like, maybe I'm not a researcher, am I a participant, or am I a researcher? Because social constructivism as a theory has assumptions of shared meaning, of multiple reality, of individual agency, on manual relation and interaction between individual and the environment. So in this way, I felt like it gave me permission to be able to talk about refugee experiences without discarding mine. But at the same time, since I was working on a phenomenology, I was thinking about what is it about this population that even though I'm thinking about their building reality and constructing reality, what was about them that I wasn't getting from the framework from Gergen's social constructivism, then that's where I found acculturation theory, about they're changing. They're coming from Africa. They're actually specifically coming from the Great Lakes region of Africa that I'm going to be showing you the map in a few minutes. But they're coming into this country not as regular immigrant. This is a subgroup of immigrant. These are people who are coming from outside of their native land, and from outside of their native land, they have applied for asylum, and they have to prove a well-founded fear of persecution and not being able to trust their country of origin, so they cannot go back. So that's where I came up with acculturation theory. In addition to the general acculturation, where you come into a new culture and you change, you either assimilate to the pre-existing group, or you maintain your culture of origin, or you get a blend of the two, and you become a completely different person who's not completely like the natives, not completely like the people that you've left behind, but something in between. And I thought that was very interesting, and that was really key into understanding the refugee movement and the refugees' access to services. Then I got to the feminist standpoint theory. This theory, I liked what it brought, what Harding talks about, and what Wood talks about. The fact that these were women, and because they are women, their view of the world is most likely going to be different from the view of, from the men's view of the world. The men's refugees are going to be interpreting what they see around them differently from the women, the way the women are going to be interpreting what's going on around them. And the standpoint theory, I think it was, for me, it brought another aspect to the refugee experience. Because remember, I'm coming from a point where I have been working as a provider of services, and yet I can relate to the refugees themselves. What was it about the refugees that kind of was not completely the same way as I was seeing things, and how was it different from the way their service providers were looking at things? That's where it comes with the standpoint theory. The standpoint theory assumes, it actually comes from this Gerd Wilhelm, which I believe is German, where he talks about the master-slave dialectic, where he compares everybody, each one of us come from a certain perspective. We look at the world around us from one standpoint. If you were a student, you look at the learning experience from a different way, differently from how the professor would look at the material. When you are when you're an employee, you look at the relationship or the work experience differently from your employer is going to be looking at. If you are a consumer of mental health, you are going to be looking at the service of mental or providing mental health care differently from the person who's providing. So I thought that standpoint really added something to my studying of the refugee phenomenon. Now, the relational cultural theory, I came up with this one because I was interacting with the refugees as client, when I went to work with them as an interpreter, when I went to work with them as someone from the community, that I realized there was a discrepancy between how their service providers wanted them to behave and what the refugees, how they wanted to behave. One very telling example is when they come in with children who are 18 of age. When their children are 18 of age, usually the service provider will want the 18-year-old to find a job. And once they get the job, they actually move out of the home, and usually they will leave the mom with the younger children. Now remember, these are people coming from Africa, and coming from Africa, many African communities are more collectivist societies, where the older you get as a child, the more responsible you become towards the family. Mom is going to be counting on you to tutor the young children, to cook for the family, to clean for the family. And when they move and they come to this country, only two?
Yeah, 15 minutes time, unfortunately, that's, but so if you'd like to, you know, maybe
Okay. All right. So I've already talked about the design, and so one point about phenomenology is about bracketing, putting aside your presupposition about the phenomenon you're studying. Now, I struggled a lot with that, and I had to go back to my advisor and say, "Well, what do I do? I can't seem to be able to do the interviews I wanted to do because every time I ask them questions, they start telling me stories about how they came to this country and how they fled and how many people they lost." And I ended up going being having through nightmares. And so the suggestion from my advisor was, you've got to bracket that. And my bracketing came out as a book. And so, but I had to put that aside before I go back into doing interviews. So I did in-depth interviews that lasted between 30 minutes, depending on how much they want to talk, to an hour and a half. And I had to go back for number check. And so the sample was the people that I've chose to participate in this research were people who have come from the Great Lakes region of Africa. Hopefully, I have. I don't see why I don't have. Oh, here's the Great Lakes region of Africa. And I wanted to let you know to point out the fact that all these people coming from Rwanda, from Burundi, from Democratic Republic of Congo, they all were fleeing from the same war, and they all ended up in the same refugee camps, and they found themselves once again as refugees here in the United States. So that I chose that as because it was a cultural clash, because they have had the same experiences. So I wanted to keep that information that was rich keep the sample as people were bringing me enough information about the phenomenon I was studying. The major findings when you do a phenomenological study is more about themes and their description of what the experience is about. And so one of the things that came out of the interviews that I did was that the refugees really could not tell me about the experiences as recipient of services without going back to how life was for them before they fled, to how life was for them during when they lived in refugee camps in the first 4 months. So the meaning really for them, it was dependent of the context, as my friend here talked about. It was dependent of the context of their fleeing of their native land into the lives in the refugee camps, and what a relief it was for them to come to this country and be received, because bottom line, nobody wants refugees. If they have been running from their home countries to the first countries of asylum, and finally when they get here, it's the first time that someone is actually welcoming them. When they get to the airport and someone says, "Welcome to the United States," they felt like they are loved, and that's actually how they said it. Fast forward, the major finding, as I was saying, the appreciation of services during the first 4 months of resettlement are very dependent on the pre-flight condition, the flight and the first asylum condition, and then the final resettlement when they get a job, where their children can go to school, where they can actually be able to speak the language, which has been a huge challenge. Now, all along my findings, I was aware that there were two parallel kind of thread that ran through all these refugee experiences. On the one hand, there was a fear of annihilation. That's why they ran from their home country. That's why they were bribing the people on the border so they can let them go. And that the fact that all those things that they were doing was geared towards self-preservation. Life as a recipient of refugee services is really dependent on the pre-flight condition, life in the first asylum, the application process, the admission to America, what they call the contract. You agree to do this so that you can do this for you. And then the journey to America that you described beautifully, and that Dr. Congress also talked about. The journey is tiring. They usually never know what to expect. They don't know the language. And then finally, they get to the United States, and they are welcome to America. I call that the honeymoon because for them, it lasted only 2 months. Bottom line, my findings are that If I were to give a meaning to a refugee's, what it means for them to be recipient of refugee services, what I found was a kind of a give and take between finding peace and really being completely disillusioned. Did I come to this place and did I find everything I wanted? They will keep telling me, we are very glad, we're happy we found peace. But other than that, you'll have to work hard for everything you'll get. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are you here? No, she was a presenter initially listed in the program that the first time remaining for questions of our two remaining presenters. Unfortunately, I'm needing to leave for the airport now, short of our completion. But if folks would like to ask questions of either of our last two presenters, feel free to stay and do that. But on behalf of the social reception and other sponsors, including HIV/AIDS section, we appreciate you being here today. So again, if you'd like to ask either of our presenter some questions, feel free to stay and there's a simply acknowledge folks and you can proceed. Thank you very much.
I have a quick question about a control group. Because you screened for drug use, I'm just wondering if you could have or would have collected a control group that did not say yes to drug use, and the reasons why they didn't do drugs compared to the other ones, because the stressors were the same, the stories were the same, and the peer pressures were the same. So yeah. Thank you for that.
Yeah, in regards to control, well, since this was a qualitative study, more thinking of a control where we really wanted to look at ideological factors associated to drug use. In regards to what are some of the reasons why some people become dependent or start using versus others, I mean, we find that in other substance use literature, but also in research with this population that it's, you know, very nuanced, as you would think. And what's really interesting to me about these specific results was that even though, yes, these men that we screened for drug use were using drugs, very, very few met dependency criteria, which we thought was very interesting. And what was interesting too, and I mentioned this in the presentation, was the way that they thought it through in terms of some of this system, and in fact, they called it a system too, of working, having the money, paying for remittances, number one, yeah, to support their family, then bills, and then the entertainment. For us as social service providers or people in the public health field, I think the implication there is, especially when we're thinking about masculine scripts or when we're thinking about vulnerable, marginalized groups and the lack of social activities that there may be for them, we need to think of things like boredom and social isolation and how programs can potentially ameliorate some of the consequences or initiation of use among these populations. But yeah, it would be interesting to see the different pathways.
Yeah. And also think the lessons learned from the people who don't use it can help guide the services to present that option to people who are using it.
Yeah.
Thanks. I have a question for you. So in regards to us as service providers, what do you recommend is the best way that we can be culturally competent to help refugees from Africa or from other places to assist them more? And especially, I mean, I think there's not a lot of dialogue or just information about refugees in general and how to help them, you know, in regards to cultural competence. Kind of, yeah.
Well, usually when I do, the thing I didn't get a chance to talk about is that after my dissertation came out, the people who actually oversee the government agency that oversees all the other agencies that we set up, refugees, the Colorado Refugee Service Program, for example, here, they invited me to go do some training with their case managers. What you find out is that really it's a two-way street. The refugees need to be educated in how to live in society. And at the same time, as you as a service provider, you also learn about them. And the challenge comes out of the fact that policy-wise, and the way that their job as a refugee resettlement agency is structured, they really don't have enough time. They're only given 8 months, they have to be self-sufficient, and self-sufficient in that term means you find a job and you're off welfare. Well, it doesn't work that way, especially working with people who come from rural areas of Africa, who have lived a long time in refugee camps, and they come with an expectation. America is one of the superpowers. So you can't tell them that there are things that are not available. And when you say the money is going to run out, they'll say, well, they know we don't have any. So maybe they're just telling us, but they keep giving us money. So there's that expectation that's really not very, very realistic. And so my suggestion is teach them, hook them with the pre-existing, the group of refugees or the other immigrants who have come before them, and make sure that those communities and those individuals are able to communicate. Because they tell each other, if you do this, if we work, if you don't, if you forget to fill in the paperwork, you're not going to get the food stamps. Or if they tell you that after 4 months you've got to find a job, you better find a job. And they give each other information that you as a case manager or a case worker didn't get a chance to give to them. And they're more, which is very interesting, they're more willing to trust the other refugees or other immigrants than they would do. I was surprised of how much those refugees come from Great Lakes region of Africa, learn from the Somali, for example, and how much they learn from the Sudanese. Even though they don't necessarily come from the same area, but they have gone through the same system, and they know that this is what you expect, and they will trust them much better than they will trust what you say. I don't know if that
I was also going to say, add to what you were saying about the period in which they receive services, the Office of Refugee and Resettlement Services has lost a lot of money, too. So that's another thing to consider.
Yes.
So when I started in public health, I worked at the refugee health services up at Lansing in Michigan. And what I learned, and I correct me if I'm wrong, that when the agencies bring refugees in the US, they're distributed in the country where it is based on population density. Mm-hmm. So I had people coming from Cuba, Afghanistan, Somalia, from Europe, and they had been just landing in a very small city. I would not even call it a city if it was in my hometown. It's a very small place with very little resources up in the coast area. People from Africa, from completely different climate, were put there, from Afghanistan were put there, from the mountains to the cold areas. And they would question me, why did the agency decide to put me here? Because there is a second movement of refugees that happens after the initial help from the refugee services. Because they decide to go where their communities are in the US. And I haven't figured it out yet. What's missing in the agency? Can't they coordinate?
The refugee system is a kind of a ladder. There is the Department of State in the United States that agrees with the UNHCR, the United Nations High Commission for Refugees, that yes, we are willing to take X number of refugees. And they usually have a backlog of people who have been accepted to be resettled, but then for any number of reasons, it didn't happen. So as they are bringing in refugees, the state government and the state department has to agree with UNHCR, yes, we're taking 1,000 refugees from Africa, for example. And then they have to ask in those different states, who has whom? And if they do have whom, do we have actually voluntary refugee agencies that are willing to take on these refugees that we're sending in? And so it's who decides on what and how much money do we get. Sometimes you have room, but these refugees are not coming with money because each state has been allocated a certain amount of money. So some states will get more refugees and others won't. And as you pointed out, once they figured out that in Florida they're doing much better, or they're going to be finding a cluster or community, then they will move around and move and leave the place where they are.
Two questions actually. First one was, did you find some of the men turn into sex work to help pay for drugs or for their bills? And the second question is, you said that there wasn't established communities of Latinos in New Orleans for them to have that sense of community, but I strongly suspect that these guys are part of strong networks of family and friends from Pueblo and Honduras or wherever they're from. And what role does those networks play as maybe a protective factor to keep them away from drugs? Actually involved in the drugs as well.
Yeah, so in regards to your first question, we were very interested in that. So we asked them about if they were ever solicited for sex work, and actually all of our participants said no. So that's what they said. They did say that they know of someone who knows someone who's been picked up for sex work. But, you know, since the purpose of this specific study is on the drug use, we didn't examine that more. But since we were interested in looking at it, we asked. So perhaps that requires more investigation because we do know that that happens. And I know there's a study in Los Angeles, actually, that looked into that a little bit more. And I can give you that reference if you're interested. In regards to your second question, what we find with this population is that, and I didn't necessarily touch upon this too much, but sending remittances or sending money back home to support your family is protective because we suspect it has to do with their purpose of coming to the United States in the first place. They're here, they've sacrificed so much, they've struggled through so much to support their family, right? So when they are able to send money back, they receive that psychological reward. Okay, I'm here, yes, I've sacrificed so much, but I'm getting something out of it. I'm serving my primary purpose. Then when we get into like masculine norms and expectations, we also have to consider that being able to send money helps fulfill that breadwinner role, right? So yes, you may not be present to fulfill that father figure role on a day-to-day basis, but the sending of the money, helping your children go to school, go to college, et cetera, feeding your children is still helping you fulfill the role of the father. So when things like workers' rights abuses like wage theft happen, and wage theft is highly pervasive among this population, a national study found 60-something percent, a study that I conducted in Austin, Texas, I would say it was more like 80% of the participants reported being victimized by wage theft, is very, very disheartening, to say the least, and has an impact on their psychological well-being because here they are working because they want to earn money to send to their family, and guess what? Now they don't have that money. They worked all this time, you know, not just the physical labor of it, but, you know, the fact that you're aiming for this higher reward and you don't get it. But also think about the disempowering quality of that and then feeling like you can't report it to the police, you can't really do anything about it. So you feel really, really disempowered. That, in that sort of specific state, that's when we find the most amount of vulnerability. Because the person feels highly disempowered, depressed, and what happens, and this again goes back to masculine norms, we find at that point the men disengage from their family. Because they, you know, masculine scripts, right? They feel like, oh, I don't want to burden my wife with this information. I don't want my mother to worry about me. And as you talked about the expectations about their family, who's in their country of origin of the United States as being this land of opportunity, and the you know, discrepancy between the reality that the immigrant worker is facing, the difficulties of life, discrimination, etc., are this huge, you know, space, right, that at that point can be surmountable, but a lot of the men disengage because they say, I don't want to deal with it. But what happens across the border, the wife starts thinking, he's not calling me, he probably found another wife or a girlfriend, I don't know what's going on, and at that point, there's also vulnerability for the family functioning, too.
I get the impression that I am not a social worker. I work in a very homogenous state of Montana, so I don't deal with a lot of refugees, but I get the feeling that you're all talking to the choir.
Mm-hmm.
And so what really bothers me is in the current political climate, this is a huge uphill battle to get people to even recognize that immigrants, legal or not, face some of these issues. And for those same people that may be able to help in any way, they think they've brought it on themselves because they came here. And it just breaks my heart to hear these stories. And I want to get politically engaged and figure out what we can do. How can I help? How can we bring more people into this conversation and help them understand these issues that are very human issues? They have nothing to do with ethnicity or color of skin or anything. They're human issues of fear and misunderstanding and miscommunication. And that's my takeaway from this. I came just to see Dr. Congress because I happened to just meet her while I was here, but it opened up a whole new way of looking at things for someone that's brand new to the area. So I wonder how you keep dealing with this.
I don't think there's one single answer to that.
Okay.
There are different pieces that will all kind of go into it. When we talk among ourselves, we probably most likely, hopefully, we do presentation in other places. We write about that. When I was doing my research, I knew that Senator Kennedy, the gentleman who just passed away, was very much involved in that whole refugee issues, immigrant issues, and he sponsored a lot of bills around immigration. Hopefully there is somebody else who's doing the same thing. As in this country, you have one, not many other countries have, is that you can go to your elected officials and say what you think. And so it's by talking about it and pushing and writing and presenting that we're going to be little by little making the information available to a larger public and larger audience, and hopefully someone will take it seriously.
Yeah. I also think that this space is a good space, right? And this is the largest public health conference, and we have this space in which we're talking about these issues. I think it's really nice and heartening to see social justice, a public health imperative. I mean, really, we're seeing social justice not just being recognized or seen as a tippy-dippy, thing. We're seeing this as being strongly correlated to public health, and I think that's very, very encouraging, right? I know certainly that the National Institute of Health are now beginning to really explicitly state that there's relationships between racism and physical and mental health problems. All these different things I think are encouraging sort of steps. And certainly there's a lot of different organizations that are doing really, really great work. But like as you said, these types of spaces and conversations that we're having, even though it may be we're preaching to the choir, hopefully we will continue having those conversations in other spaces as well.
Well, and I can just comment on here. I was walking on that.
Really, the end goal of my research is to help inform programming culturally responsive and contextually responsive programming to this marginalized population, right? But it's also an interesting space to be because I need to make sure that I word my research in a specific way because I don't want to reinforce stereotypes or notions or ideas that people may have about this population, right? I mean, when we're talking about crack use among Latino American workers, it needs to be within the public health frame, and hopefully it's not co-opted into something that's part of a different political agenda. Because even though I've presented you this, and we understand that this is qualitative research, it's with people participants, there's possibility of that being overgeneralized and using another sort of perspective. So keeping all of that in mind, and it's not just me, other people who work with marginalized populations, we need to be careful with these types of things. But at the end of the day, I do the research that I do with the hopes that I'm informing and adding to an awareness about this population with the end goal of informing services.
Yeah, unfortunately that happens to a lot of us where our work is taken. And I mean, even now, we do, I mean, I do majority of my work under the radar of the media. I never hold press conferences about the stuff we're doing because it's taken by Minuteman and white supremacy groups and it's turned around. And it's used against the community, and so at the same time as wanting to increase the requirements to raise awareness, it's very dangerous, and I think that's very dangerous for us to erase some of these issues, and so I'm a lot more jaded than most people in this room, I think, because I've just been hit over and over again by our work being taken and those stereotypes being built, and the case against immigrants being made is really hard. California, Southern California, especially where I'm from, it's really difficult to do this work.
Usually pays with cash.
Yes. Always.
Usually.